And I give the little boy his break there, and he sold every album he had, 50 albums for $5. But then when these others had turned him down, when they seen how well he went over, they got ashamed. They left. But I put him right on the middle of my show. I gave him prime time right in the best part of my show. So I always figured, you know, don't never mistreat nobody because you may want a hand from them sometimes. And I've always made a vow in business and I will always try to help people because I had to help one time, still have to have it. And you don't never know. The old dog you kick may be the dog you want to lick your hand.
Melvin, one thing real quick. Jeff, run out to the car.
We do have some Buddy and I have some albums.
Yeah, and get the contracts for Melvin's September Festival. I know, Melvin, you worked as you've done everything that can possibly be done in a bluegrass band. You've worked as a sideman. You played bass right. for Ralph Stanley. You played guitar for Ralph Stanley. You sung bass for Ralph Stanley. You've
done comedian work.
You've been a comic.
Crazy fella. I'm still crazy.
You've been a band leader. You've been an MC. You've been a manager. You've been an agent. You've been a promoter, public relations, and you've been a recording artist.
There's one thing I haven't done, and I hope, buddy, that I live long enough to do, and I would like for you to be around. I want to write a life history. I want to write my life history of show business. I want to do a book someday. If I live long enough and never forget enough money, I want to publish a book from the beginning to the end of my career in music, and people that I've worked with has gone on, and just do a book for about bluegrass music and old-time music. That's one thing I want to do before I get too old and can't think of all the stuff that I've done. I want to do that, and because I've had so many people has talked to me about it. People that's in the business has asked me, the Lewis family and Ralph Stanley and Ralph and Monroe. There's so many people asked me to do a story. You know, I think I'd like to do it some of these days because I think it would be interesting. You know, for not only for my music career, but some of the old timers still in, some that's gone on. People really, there's things that they would like to know about them that they never have learned about. Because some of them has died, and they really never knew the true facts of about the things in their music career.
That book could, I'm sure, be used as a textbook in any school. And one other thing, before I met Melvin, I didn't have much of an idea of what kind of a job I was going to be getting into. I'd known him for years, but through the school year, Melvin and Ray, and usually take maybe one other person with you. I have played the part of a costume character. Melvin does cultural programs for the public schools in Eastern Kentucky. Now, this is not through a grant. This is not through money sponsored by the state and coming out of tax money. The kids come to school, they pay a quarter, 50 cents, whatever they can afford. They come and hear this show, and they do a music show for them. They do a little comic skit for them. The kids love it. I've seen them do it. I did it with them for 4 or 5 years, and they've done it for the last 25 or 30 years. And there are kids in Eastern Kentucky. I was down there just a couple weeks ago to do his TV show with him, and some kid came up to me and said, "I know who you are. I saw you when I was in the eighth grade over at Upper Feds Creek," I think he said. And Melvin Goins was responsible for that. But thousands of little school kids see this guy and his brother every year at school. He makes it a point to go around and do it.
Some people, you know, they think they're too good to go back and play the small places, but I enjoy it because I think little children, I love little children. I like to work the children. I think it's better to teach something good they'll remember and something's decent and right as a bunch of meanness or getting out there and doing something else, you know. Just like there's a highway patrol stopped me back 4 or 5 years ago. I was coming out of Hazard, Kentucky. I'd been over doing some TV work and he's doing a road check, checking for driver's license, you know. And so I pulled up and I stuck my driver's license out to him and he went to laughing. Well, I thought, I must be awful funny. He said, "Stick your driver's license back in your pocket." And he said, "I know you." He said, "You come and played my school when I was in the sixth grade." And he was a good friend. I guess we sat there and talked a half hour, but he remembered my show when he was in the sixth grade of school at Macon, Kentucky, and Whitesburg, right out of Whitesburg, Kentucky. At the Macon School, that's the name of the school. It's a little bitty school set right back up on the top of a hill in a coal camp, and they went to the sixth grader, had the old slide partitions with the old potbelly stoves in it. And he remembered my show when he was in the sixth grade.
But you used to do those shows the same way you do the same way you do the candy shows. You'd go to the schools and do the show for the kids. That's kind of advertisement for late that night. Then they'd go into the schools maybe on Friday or Saturday, the same schools, and do an evening program, and of course, kids would bring their parents in to see the shows. You used to get people like Lester Flatt, Don Reno, the Stanley Brothers, Osborne Brothers, to come in and do those shows with you.
Well, I've worked every one of them just about in the business, you know, that has played these schoolhouses, you know. And a lot of it's going to go back to the schoolhouse days, because this kind of music, I think, will go on. But I think that it'll go back to some of the old schoolhouse days, because there's so many in it, we're going to need room. And I don't know how many, a lot of the young people has worked the schoolhouse day shows, but you have a lot of fun. You don't make as much money as you go out and do a big TV series or a college, but it's still all good, and you're still promoting and doing the old bluegrass music the way that it started back years ago. And I always try to make it a policy to put on a good, clean show anywhere I go, if it's a small crowd or if it's a big crowd. I have worked the crowds high as 20, 25 people and do a full show. So many people, I've seen them go because they wasn't a house full, they'd leave. But I'll pick just the same to 25 as I would 2,500, because them people paid the same amount of money to get in if you had the house full. So I think you should give them a fair shake and a fair show.
Now, people like Melvin never get, as far as I'm concerned, all the credit that they deserve for the kind of things that they've done throughout the music industry. But I know 2 or 3 years ago, Melvin and Ray won the Carter Stanley Memorial Award, I think, didn't you, for your contribution to bluegrass music. And that was one thing that was richly deserved, and I'm sure you deserved a lot of other awards for it.
Yeah, and we also was picked as one of the old traditional groups to go to Washington, D.C. and work the Smithsonian Institution in 1973. We went there and worked for the state of Kentucky, the governor, and for old-time traditional music, and represented the state of Kentucky, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. I do, yeah. I carry the five major pieces: is the guitar, the five-string banjo, the fiddle, the mandolin, and the bass. I've never used any electric instruments. I've not got anything against electric instruments, but I try to play it the way it originated and started, the old doghouse upright bass, and I try to follow that the way it started. I mean, I love all kinds. I'm not against any other kind of music, but that was just the foundation I built my style on, like it started, and I still stayed with it. My brother, Ray. Yeah. I have another brother. There's two banjo pickers in our family. 9 boys and 1 girl. And they're all of them just about picks and sings. And like he said, I have 3 other brothers that plays, and they work off of 7. They're on 7 different TV stations. They do a gospel. My other brother he's a minister. He's a banjo player, the one that's younger. Then they work off in TV out of Bluefield, WHIS, and they play music. And then I had another brother that worked with the late Mel Street. He played country music, the boy that was killed a few years ago. He played drums for him.
Remind them I want a copy of their record album, those crooks.
Okay. Yeah, you played fiddle.
They owe me one.
That's right.
Did he?
Yeah, we've always done it. In fact, I done that when I worked with the Stanley Brothers. I carried the name of Big Wilbur, and I wore a polka dot suit. Big Wilbur. There used to be another man called Cousin Wilbur. He used to work with Bill Monroe, played bass, and wore comedy clothes. But Carter Stanley hung that name on me, and I wore a polka dot suit with a black derby hat, and I done crazy stuff. Well, that was the part that you broke in the show, you know, that it was a funny part. Everybody back in those days, a bluegrass show, everybody expected a comedian and tell funny jokes. It kind of made the people revive the crowd up, and it was a different thing, you know. It just wasn't one thing. And I tell you, I think a lot of it is somebody's going to go back. In fact, I've got mine. I'm going to go back and start doing some of the old stuff like that was done back in the 40s and 50s, because I think it's still, it deserves to be there. There's so many people has quit taking time, and they think that they're too good to do it. But I thought bluegrass started with that. It started with a comedian. The comedian always played the bass and done comedy work in a bluegrass show. Bill Monroe was the originator of bluegrass, and he started it with a comedian. He always carried a comedian.
Did he get that from country
music? That was started for country. No, it didn't come from country music.
Vaudeville.
Yeah, it just come back in the old days. I know the first comedian ever I knew Bill Monroe had was Cousin Wilbur. Years ago, he played the bass, you know, and done comedies. Everybody, Stanley Brothers, everybody carried them till back about 15 years ago. Everybody dropped them. I mean, that's I still do it in my show to schools and things like that. But I guess they think on the Bluegrass Festival now, which is a tight schedule, I guess they don't think that they have time to do it, to tell a few jokes and do a little comedy song, something different. But I thought it made a real good show. And I think the people is kind of getting hungry for it again. I think it would be a good turnaround, would be good for shows.
Well, today you've only got 45 minutes to do a show, whereas before you had a whole evening.
You're right.
So you only got so much time to get your music.
That's right. You don't have the time to get it in now like you did back in those days. But I think anybody could go back and at least take 5 minutes or something to tell a joke, because I know sometimes a good joke's made my day, made me happy, and I felt like a Dickens. And just a good, funny joke just perked me right up. Yeah.
Any more
about all I've told has been jokes today.
Those nice things you said about us, brother?
No, I just a kid about that. No, we have a good little comedy routine. It's real good, you know. I mean, I enjoyed it. I know I never forget the first time ever I done comedy. I, like, scared my mother to death. As for ever I left home, you know, I went upstairs and I put an old ragged suit on and an old hat and chopped it full of holes and put an old pair of wire glasses on and broke the lens out, you know, and blacked my face, and I, like, scared my mother to death. And from then on, I done comedian work, you know.
Which skit are you doing this year in school?
I haven't come up with what I'm going to carry this year yet.
What did you do last year?
I done a ghost act last year. I done an act that I dressed as a sheriff, and this fellow robbing this bank. And then I had to stay in this haunted house, and then this ghost comes out and sits aside, and then I jump up and take off with the money, and the ghost gets after me, and I leave the whole premises of the school ground.
If I'm not mistaken, is that how Curly Lambert got the name Ghost?
No.
That's how was that?
The goat.
No, he got goat. I know that. I remember that. But.
Yeah. Well, poor Curly, he sure hated to wear that sheet. You take a white bed sheet and sew it together and put it over top of a man, you scare a child to death in school. But that's the funny part about it. That's where they all get it. But they don't really know what it is, but the children get a bang out of it. But you got to have a different show to capture children's audience. You can't go out and just play straight music. You got to have a little comedy routine, something funny, just like cartoons on TV. You got to have something different to attract their attention.
Buddy, yes. What was your character when you were in the skit?
Tell them how many times you got whipped the belt.
Let me put it this way. I always got the worst end of the deal. A couple of times I was Frankenstein. I mean, I was Frankenstein. Me.
Short Frankenstein.
A couple of times I was the ghost. And a couple of times, every comedian has to have a straight man. A couple of times I played straight man to Melvin.
What was the act we done? You always screamed and hollered in so much.
That was the regular show, Melvin.
He would stoop over. He's always stooping over to get something. I'd make him sit down. When he stooped over, I'd pull my belt off, and I'd whack him. He'd jump about
that
high off the floor.
I remember that. We had Melvin was. Now this was me and you and Glenn Duncan.
Right.
Dave Evans was in on it a couple times. But Melvin was the great white hunter, ragu.
we had
him dressed up in a shirt kind of like this is my Falkland Island shirt. So we had him dressed up in a shirt like this, and one of the helmets and the shorts. I can't remember exactly how the show went, but
I can't remember either. I had so many of them.
You were out hunting wild animals. I remember that, and
yeah.
I think I left. I changed from straight man to bear in that one.
Yeah,
boy, them bear suits got hot. Summertime school shows.
Do you do this while you're playing music, or in between?
That's after you break. That's the last part of the show. You close the show out with that.
We'd have little kids running all over the place, going to the bathroom, everything, trying to, right there sometimes. Well, I've only got one other thing to ask you about. You've seen bluegrass music at high periods where it was real popular, all the bands were working, and everybody having a good time. You've seen bluegrass music where it was pretty low and hardly anybody working. What were probably the lowest places for bluegrass music? And I will ask, I know rock and roll had a lot to do with it, and the Beatles had a lot to do with some of it. They didn't mean to have a lot to do with it, but it's the way it worked out. When were some of the bad times?
The bad times, well, Buddy, back after I left the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers, seemed like the lean years was 1955, 56, 57. That was three rough years. Of course, Presley had just come out with Rock and Roll Hot in 1956, mm-hmm. and things like that. And it was really rough to try to get a crowd anywhere. And the only way we survived back then, like I said a while ago, we'd go out and play these schoolhouses and have what they call box suppers, beauty contest, ugly man's contest. And they spend so much money on a cake, you know, this girl was going to win this cake. I've sold a menu of 49 set chocolate cake for $100. And see, you give the school the percentage, and they'd run the business. Maybe this man was bidding on his daughter, or this boy was bidding on his girlfriend. And back we had to play the schoolhouse days there. And in the drive-in theaters, they worked you and give you 50% of what you took in. The admission was like 75 cents. They took the movie off the top and took all the advertising off the top. And sometimes you'd have $35, $40 left to split between the whole band and guys. By all you guys, that's how all you'd have left. I have worked even with Cardin and Ralph, the Stanley Brothers, big names of Stanleys, and Flat and Scruggs, and the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. And a top money then was $100 a night for the whole band and guys and everything. If you made $100, that was a powerful night at a drive-in theater or a percentage, $100. Huh? You took the $100, you paid all the four men, you paid for the advertising, the guys, all that. So you had anywhere from the neighborhood of $12 to $15, maybe $15 left. That's per man, $15 a piece.
And one of the things that's changed in the last, probably with the oncoming of people like the Country Gentlemen and the more modern bluegrass groups, they have more of an even split. They all share responsibilities. They maybe own a company.
Well, it's incorporated now. Maybe they're all partners. You know,
and,
all share.
And you have to explain at the time, there was usually one guy who was the brains of the entire bluegrass band. He handled all the booking. Well, this Melvin's done this. I know. I worked for him. Handled all the booking, handled all the advertising, handled all the arrangements, had a vehicle, kept it up, and all anybody else had to do was travel and work with them. And so any profit that was earned in a situation like that was always well-deserved.
Sure was.
And now how about giving me $5? But when were some of the good times, and why were they good?
Well, the good times.
I said good.
Well, yeah, me and Ray, I'll tell you when me and Ray, our biggest break, our good break was, I worked with the Stanley Brothers from 1966 to 69. Well, then I left the Stanley Brothers, and me and Ray, we formed our own group again, the Goins Brothers, 1969. And we got started playing, you know, and festival stuff. And then we got into it, having festivals of our own, you know, promoting our own festivals. And then in 1975, we got our own regular television show. And then we got the festival started. And then we got booking on all these festivals. And I'd say from 1971, it started going up, you know, and it started getting better and better and better, you know. Bluegrass festivals is the best thing that's ever happened to bluegrass music, because it's really the only time that entertainers has made a halfway living, you know, in the last, since 1970, for the last 14 years, it's been the only way that even people's halfway eat what they really wanted to eat and have a few dollars left, the festivals, because back before that, I mean, it was rough, boys. Like I said, you went out back before that, you'd make $50, $60 a night, some nights not even that much. So you can figure what you can buy and have off of $35, $40 a night split up between entertainers and gas and everything. And it run in a cycle like that for a long time. And then after the festivals got started, then it got bigger, and then the promoters started promoting, and then it got into the colleges and things, and it's just been a good thing that's happened to it in the last 15 years. I'd like to see back before some of the entertainers passed on, like Carter Stanley. Carter died just about the time the festival started in 66. And I would really like to see fellas like that lived to made some good, decent money and had a good bus to rode in. He never had a bus to ride in, nothing. He rode cars and four or five in a car, maybe a bass fiddle sometimes. And you maybe go two or three days and never pull your shoes off getting to bed. And that's really a lot of wear and tear on a man's body, you know. I've done it. And so you can really be thankful that since then, you know, even myself, of course, the other fellow's been long. We've got able now to where we can afford us a bus to travel in, you know, and you've got beds that you can lay down and sleep. And when you get to place, you don't have to be in an old motel or something other that no air conditioning is burned up. You got a bus, you can sit back and you can lay down and relax and rest. And you can haul your clothes, they look halfway decent. And things like this, there's been so much improvement in bluegrass music it's come along in the later years. Back in the early years, there wasn't nothing like that because it was just pile up a car, boy, and ride all night long with your knees up and your stomach, you know, and your sitar, and your clothes looked like a dog bed when you went to put them on. And so it's really been a lot of improvement in the last 15 years. And Monroe and all of them, they've all got buses and things since the last 15 years that they normally rode an old station wagon or an old car. So it's really been a lot of changes.
Of course, back in the early 50s, I know Monroe went a lot of times for $100, $150. He might have asked for more, but he didn't. Ended up not taking it.
I have worked with Bill Monroe. I worked in Pineville, Kentucky one night, and Bill Monroe had 26 paid admissions. 26 people at 75 cents a head.
1950s?
And the 50s. And the theater manager got half of that. So you spent 26 people at 75 cents a head. That's not much money left. That will more or less than buy two or three hot dogs.
What's he asking now?
Now $6,000 a day. And he gets it, and he deserves it.
I have a question over
because
here.
Because he donated his life for it, and I'd like to see any man that's spent as many years as Bill Monroe has in the business, I say it's coming to him, and he deserves it because he's rode millions and millions of miles and went a lot of years, just barely survived.
Amen.
And I'm glad to see him do it. Now, I'm glad to see anybody get a break and make it because it's coming to them. Because any time that you ride this road, I don't care who it is, you on the road, you get unregular sleep, you get unregular meals. Sometimes you don't get no meals. You don't have enough money to buy them. I've seen times that I didn't have money to eat on. Go into a restaurant and maybe eat one donut and get a glass of water because I didn't have enough money to buy a cup of coffee. Eat bologna sandwiches and sleep on hardwood floors. Eat bologna sandwiches for breakfast.
School teachers do that.
Well, I tell you, it's all hard. But I'm really glad to see it. It's been a good change, and now that hit was for the best.
Do you have a question over here?
Tell us a little bit about the recording business, about the money in records and that sort of thing.
Back when I first started recording, like I said, there wasn't any albums made back in those days. There wasn't any tapes, cassettes, 8-tracks. It was only when you went into a recording studio, you done 4 numbers. That was called a session of records. In 1954, that paid you $41.50 to drive from here, wherever you was, to Nashville, Tennessee to record a session of records. RCA Victor, $41.50. They took out your tax, and you had probably $37, $38 after they took out Social Security and your tax. That was 4 albums, and that's what you made. That's what the side, and the leader got double. Like Ezra Klein, well, they doubled his $41.50. which was $83, and we got $41.50. The side man did. You cut 4 numbers. That was a recession of records.
Now, was that union scale?
That was union scale then.
Who owned the record? Yeah, did you not get a percentage when it sold?
If it sold, you got a percentage off of that.
How much?
I think you got 5 cents a record for a single.
Could you buy your records and then sell them like at your shows and make money?
Not then you couldn't.
Really?
Not then. They had their own distributor, the big companies, because they'd done. If you bought a record, you had to go into a music store to buy it. You didn't carry any on the road to sell back in them days.
Of course, you have to understand, at that time, and I think Melvin will agree with me, people would have paid to get on a record label.
Oh, if you could get on a record, that was a big thing.
Yeah, but even at that time.
But then there wasn't no such thing as you taking your albums out there and setting up your tapes to sell them, because it all went through the distributors and through the record companies, and the only way you got any pay was royalties, so much percent off each one of those records sold. That was all the money you got. You had copyrights. They had copyrights. You had a copy, too.
I mean, the copyright, is it in your name or in the record company's name?
Well, it's in both names. You have it published and copyrighted.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like the writer on the record, and it's published through BMI, and then it's copyrighted with the Congress or Library in Washington, D.C. It's copyrighted there, you see, the lyrics, the words, and published through the companies. Like Hill and Range. Hill and Range published about all of our material when we record for RCA Victor. See, that was the name of the publishing company. And as the record sold in, you got royalties off of it, you know.
You split with the publishing company.
Yeah, you split with the publishing company. It's a 50-50 deal. You split with the publishing companies. Like if you sold an album, every album that you sold would come to 20 cents. You got a dime off that album, they got a dime.
What if somebody else did one of your songs?
What if they did it?
Yeah.
They had, well, how much it recorded, they paid you royalties if it sold.
Wouldn't that usually
Well, never was no big money, you know, back that you got off that stuff, you know. It was never, because the deal was, you always owed the recording companies because they always figured you never sold enough to get any royalties. You had to pay them back first before you made anything. In other words, you paid them back what they invested in you to bring you in record before you made anything. That's right, sharecropper. That's exactly what it was.
But the exposure was well
worth. But the exposure and get to being on a record company, get known, was worth the difference. Because if you didn't get on record and didn't get known, nobody would never know about you. That's where it pays off, is the publicity and getting you professional jobs playing music and making you a name. Because when they spin your records on the radio stations, well, if they say, here's Lester Flatt, here's Bill Monroe, well, that's how they learn about you, and that's how they found about you, by playing your records on the radio stations.
In your opinion, what's the most underrated, unknown band that's been around? You know, somebody that's good but unheralded.
Well, it'd be hard to say because there's a lot of them today in that category that really has never had what was coming to them. There's so many, you know. It'd be hard to just call out one certain name that's really paid their dues but never did get what was coming to them.
Who would you say is the highest paid bluegrass group today?
Bill Monroe. Yeah.
Who would be next? The Osmond Brothers?
Seldom Seen. It gets big money. And Bill Monroe and
the
Osmond Brothers gets big pay. They get good money for playing music.
What the Country Gentlemen?
Country Gentlemen, they're about the same category as the Osmonds.
What about the Lewis family?
The Lewis family makes good money. They get, I believe the last show I had them, they got $2,250 a day. And I first started working for $800. They went from $800 to $2,250.
What do you think of Sheldon Sheen's approach to bluegrass?
What do I think about them? Well, they've got their own style. They don't play traditional bluegrass. They got more of a modern bluesy sound. I mean, they don't play traditional bluegrass. What do I think about them? I like their music. I like their music, you know, as far as they're singing. I think they've recorded some good stuff, you know, but they just don't. I would want to play the type of music they play. Because I learned, I guess as the old saying, I come from the old school and I learned it the way that the old traditional bluegrass started.
Do you think that hurts traditional bluegrass? I mean, I think there's a lot of things you can't even really call.
Well, I tell you what, I think some of this stuff is played, it's called bluegrass, and it's not. And I think that's a bad influence because you take, like, if you'd never seen a bluegrass festival or you never seen nobody come in and play bluegrass and you heard something like this, it didn't sound right, you say, well, is that what they call bluegrass? I think that's what's caused a lot of the disc jockeys on the radio stations that they won't play it. And if so much stuff is recorded, I'm not knocking nobody, but if so much stuff is recorded, I don't think has been ready to go on a record. Well, when somebody comes and hears it, and if it's not got everything together, they think, well, boy, that's a bad sound. A bad sound can hurt a good man, or if they're not ready to do it, he can. So I think stuff like it hurts, you know. I think anything should be to where the people can appreciate it, and that way it helps, you know. I think if you do it the other way, that it hurts. Of course, everybody has to learn, and I'm still learning myself. I know everybody can't be perfect, but I think anybody ought to. I think when you record something, put on record, that it ought to be decent, and anybody would care if it would like it, would buy it. Because when you put it on and people won't buy it, you know there's something wrong. If there's something about it that's not right, and when the disc jockeys won't play it, there's something that they don't like, or they would play it. I do think that bluegrass has never had the break and never had what really was justice to it, as many years and many people's put their life into it, because there's so many of the radio stations won't play it. But you turn right back around and listen to your TV stations, how many of them has got a five-string banjo in the background cutting all your big TV commercials and got some kind of a background behind it with all your big top-selling commercials on TV, but still, if they don't like it, they won't play it. But still, they'll use it to attract people's attention. So I wonder why they do that. There's got to be something good there, or they wouldn't do it. Just like the Hee Haw Show. If it hadn't been funny, it would never made it. But it's funny enough that people liked it, so it captured the audience.
I worked at this radio station here about 5 or 6 years ago and tried my best to promote bluegrass music. That's all I would play. I had a local.
Well, I don't know what it is. I think some of the disc jockeys, some of the owners of stations, I think that they really like it, but they're ashamed of how this brought up, well, they call us rednecks. I think they really truly like it, but they're just ashamed to own up to it. I know radio station managers right now, I won't call their names, and I know how they're raised. They come from right about the same neck of woods I've got. But when they got the job, it's just like the old saying, some people, a job and money makes a fool out of some people. That's just, I'm making it that way, but really, they like it. It's just like some people like to go in a restaurant. They love to sit down with a big bowl of beans and cornbread and onions, but they're afraid to hurt their pride, afraid Uncle Tom or some big shot will be looking at them. But I tell you what, I'm going to do what I want to do, and if they don't like it, they can leave because I'm paying my money, and that's what I want.
Amen.
And that's the same.